Next case for argument, United States v. Sura. Mr. Beavers.
May it please the Court, Doug Beavers on behalf of Mr. Sura. Both parties in this case agree that the standard of review is plain error for the appeal waiver issue. The government appears to concede that the error was plain and obvious, but the government argues that there was no serious effect on the fairness or public reputation.
Mr. Beavers, does your client want to withdraw his plea and start over?
No, he just wants to get resentenced.
But then I don't understand what the point of this argument is. If there's a prejudicial violation of Rule 11, which is what you're arguing, the remedy is to withdraw the plea and start over. It's not to redact the plea agreement.
But I thought he was asking for both, actually, if you look
at it. That's why I asked.
Yeah, absolutely. And,
right? So is your answer yes or is it no?
Well, he doesn't want to. He wants to get out of this plea agreement and move ahead to sentencing. If that requires him to replead open plea, that's fine.
In your reply brief, you say two different things. In your principal brief, you say first he wants resentencing, but then you say in the alternative, remand with instructions to allow the parties to choose whether to withdraw from the plea agreement, have Mr. Sura enter a new plea. And then in the reply brief, you say he's willing to enter a blind plea. In other words, he's willing, with a blind plea, not to have any benefits from the government if there were any.
Absolutely.
So, I mean, Judge Easterbrook's question was the first one that came to my mind, too, about this, because we have lots of cases that say you can't just excise paragraph 30 from a plea agreement and stick with the rest of it.
That's correct, Your Honor. He's not asking for any of the benefits of the plea agreement, just to have it either to have him go back sentenced as if by an open plea, because the plea colloquy, other than the appeal waiver, has no problems with it, and I think it is a valid guilty plea, and he should be just resentenced as the defendant in Lutis was.
Why would that benefit him? I don't understand.
Because, Your Honor, we believe that as to the second ground, that it is very clear that he should not have been sentenced, that he should have received the benefit of the reduction for sporting and target use of firearms, and that would bring his offense level down quite a bit lower, even if the government is successful in arguing that it should be then upward departed above that low level. We still believe it would end up
no worse. You're taking a chance, though, aren't you?
Yes, Your Honor. There is always a chance.
Oh. Yeah, I'm looking at page 10 of your reply brief now, where you respond to the government's argument, where you indicate that Mr. Sura, who's now 73, is that right?
Yes,
has expressed his willingness to be resentenced as if he had pled guilty without a plea agreement.
So yes, Your Honor.
I think you have to, that's the best you can do. You can't finesse this any further than that.
That is. It is also the fastest method, and because of the time that he has served, having him replead by open plea would, if the court were to take the position that there was no way to just send him back as if it were an open plea, he would intend to plead guilty by open plea and then move directly to sentencing at that same hearing. If the government does intend to charge the additional firearm charges which he admitted in his plea colloquy, he would be willing to open plea to those charges as well. Our position is those would make no difference because of the relevant conduct. They would have no effect except if the government really wants additional special assessments. But that's the only... I see no reason why the government would want to do that, but if they want to charge him with the additional firearms, he will plead to those. But he just wants to be resentenced by an open agreement as quickly as possible.
his previous scrapes with the law were in state court. Now, do the state judges advise people, you know, when they plead guilty about that they're waiving? Do they have the same kind of plea colloquy as in the federal court?
Your Honor, I have not practiced in Wisconsin state court, but my understanding is that the constitutional rule for guilty plea proceeding is very similar and is followed throughout most of the country, that most courts that I've been in the three or four states I've practiced in all require the judge to warn them that they can't appeal after a guilty plea, meaning they can't appeal your conviction.
So wouldn't he know that that was going to be the same in this case?
No, Your Honor, because the function of the U.S. sentencing guidelines is so different, and the idea of the guidelines and the appeal process is a really substantial part of a federal case.
No, but I think what you said is that he would be aware that he couldn't appeal his conviction. And Rule 11 now requires advice if a particular plea agreement also includes a waiver of the right to appeal a sentence. That's a different point. There are plenty of guilty pleas where the person files a notice of appeal and complains about the sentence in one fashion or another. But this particular agreement in paragraph 30 waived his right to appeal his sentence and also to file a 2255. And that's the thing that might actually have his prior experience misleading him into thinking that he could still appeal if he thought, well, I can't complain about my conviction, of course, because I pleaded guilty, but I can go ahead and complain about the sentence.
Yes, Your Honor, that's what I mean. The fact that had he skimmed through the agreement, he would, and seen the words appeal waiver, that would reflect his experience in state court, that they, where the judges say, you can't appeal your conviction. It wouldn't focus his attention on the importance of what he's waiving in terms of the sentencing guidelines. And I think the court can also look at what the difference between this case and Lutis' case is, that this defendant is extremely different from the practicing lawyer and friend of bank officer and Lutis. And I think that in this case, the court may have to decide between whether to go with the three circuits that lean toward the defense in saying that where there is no mention of the appeal waiver, they automatically will remand it and vacate the appeal waiver and vacate the plea unless there's some really good evidence. In contrast, the Tenth Circuit in Edgar is putting the burden of proof on the defendant, but in that case there really was no evidence at all to suggest that business owner had any reason to not have read his contract and understood all the terms. But in this case, we have a person who has serious psychiatric problems. When we look at the plea proceeding, I should mention the government does make a mistake in its brief where it says that the defendant said that he says that he was never declared incompetent. That's not exactly what he said. He said he didn't know if he'd ever been declared incompetent. That's what the transcript shows. He said he didn't know if his medications caused him to misunderstand what's going on. This is someone who doesn't know a lot and is someone who has severe impulse problems, which would match someone who would not necessarily read something very carefully. Thank you.
Okay, thank you, Mr. Beavers. Mr. Ingraham?
Good morning, Your Honors. My name is Stephen Ingram, an assistant United States attorney from the Eastern District of Wisconsin. I was also counsel for the government and the district court. Your Honors, as you've been discussing, one of the issues in this...
So you bear part of the responsibility for the mess we're in now.
Yes, I do, Your Honor. I should have...
I simply don't comprehend how we can see violations of Rule 11B. It's just a checklist, right? And you and the district judge have got to be going through the checks together.
Yes, Judge, and I failed to remind the district judge to make an explicit waiver of the right to appeal as it appeared in paragraph 30 of the plea agreement. So, yes, to answer your question, I do bear some of the responsibility.
Well, not only that, I mean, sometimes it's possible to bail out of these things on a harmless error ground if, for example, the prosecutor mentioned it or if there is at least some statement from the judge to the effect of did you review all the paragraphs of this agreement with your lawyer or anything. There's just nothing here. There's this seemingly rather confused elderly person signing a plea agreement and this whole, you know, A through N list practically in Rule 11b1 is treated quite casually.
Judge, as was noted when the opposing counsel was arguing, Mr. Sura had a fairly extensive history of fairly recent appearances in the criminal court context.
Right, but what I can't tell from that is whether in the state courts prosecutors try for appeal waivers with quite the zeal that U.S. attorneys' offices try for appeal waivers, because if it's just a minor sentence, maybe the person just accepts his sentence and carries on. And an appeal waiver, waiving a right to appeal a sentence and the right to file a 2255 motion, is quite a different creature. And in fact, Mr. Sura says something in the course of these proceedings that he signed the plea agreement because that's what he thought he had to do to plead guilty. That didn't give me any confidence that he was aware that this particular provision was in it.
Well, but the plea agreement itself, though, although it's true that the Rule 11 colloquy was not what it should have been, the plea agreement itself is extensive in saying repeatedly that I have read the agreement, and especially the very last page, Your Honor, where there's an extensive, right above the signature, and on the signature page there's a statement about how I've reviewed every paragraph or I've reviewed every provision of this plea agreement with my lawyer and I understand all of everything.
And the judge didn't review that with him either.
That's true, he didn't.
Not quite. I mean, he didn't really make sure that the lawyer had covered all of this. And Mr. Sura testifies that he signed the agreement because that's what he thought he had to do to plead guilty.
But
this agreement goes much further than that.
Well, there's no indication, though, that Mr. Sura was incompetent. He is a troubled person, as indicated by his spate of...
He probably has physical problems with brain damage to, you know, impulse control areas, but that's beyond the scope of this record, I recognize. But
he had held employment throughout his adult life, and there's just no indication that he was not able to read either... that he was not able to read and understand the provisions of the plea agreement. So I think that...
Why do we bother with Rule 11 at all, then? Why don't we just have people sign plea agreements and be done with it?
Well, this plea hearing, Your Honor, while not what it should have been, because it didn't contain the express waiver of paragraph 30, it wasn't nothing either. There's quite an extensive review of the right to trial. There was the statement of facts.
That actually weakens your argument, right?
That the plea agreement...
If you have an extensive discussion of everything except the right to appeal the sentence, then maybe he would think that wasn't part of it, right?
Well, the discussion was extensive. I don't know that...
Extensive of other things, right? So...
Well... But there was no indication, for example, that...
Hey, what if the judge just said, do you know you're giving up your right to confront witnesses against you? Do you know what witnesses are and what confrontation means and what the Supreme Court said in this case and in that case? And if That was an incredibly detailed examination of one aspect of the plea agreement. Wouldn't that mislead the defendant?
It could, Your Honor, but there was nothing, unlike one of the, I believe it was a First Circuit case where the Rule 11 colloquy actually contradicted the plea agreement as to waiver of appeal. There was no such contradiction in this case. In fact, there was nothing at all in the Rule 11 exchange that would have indicated to Mr. Sura or anyone else in the room that all of the rights that were expressly waived in the plea agreement weren't being waived during the Rule 11 hearing. So the fact that it was omitted, there was nothing in the Rule 11 hearing that in any way contradicted the terms of the plea agreement. Your Honors, in addition to that, I would ask that you also affirm the district judge with regard to the sentence, and especially in particular with regard to the reduction for having a gun for sporting or collection purposes. I believe that the burden of proof is on Mr. Sura to get such a reduction, and there was no proof, or that Mr. Sura failed to meet his burden of proof.
What about this World War II thing that he'd never had any ammunition for?
I think that was for collection purposes, or the firearm itself was for collection purposes. However, a person of Mr. Sura's record, the district judge could readily find, should not be in possession, not only of his record, but the fact that he was on probation at the time. Application note 10 to the...
Well, are you talking about departing from... I mean, the guideline says if you hold it for collection purposes, then...
Then the reduction applies.
Yeah, then the reduction applies. And so you just said, yes, he held it for collection purposes.
He did. But there's an application note 10, Your Honor, that talks about the extent to which possession is forbidden by local law. And part of what gave rise to this case in the first place was Mr. Sura was on probation, and he was not to possess any firearms pursuant to his probation. And so that factor, the fact that he was on probation and his possession was forbidden by state law, was also germane to the district court's decision as to whether or not the reduction applied.
Okay.
Thank you, Your Honors.
Abraham. Mr. Beavers, how much time does he have? 1 minute?
First, to address what the prosecutor said last, I think this argument that the guideline note that discusses whether it violates local law, I think every state prevents a person who's a felon from possessing firearms. That doesn't seem to be what it's going at. I think what it's going at is whether the type of gun in those circumstances of how it was possessed, whether that was restricted by local law, so that had he possessed this Beretta in Chicago, where local law bans handguns, that's a consideration to suggest there may be something involved. However, this is Wisconsin, which is an open carry state, allowing people to carry handguns around.
Even if they're on probation?
No, but it doesn't say the extent to which prohibited. If the guideline were to mention that the way this judge interpreted it was that all felons are not allowed to possess firearms, so they're always restricted, so that guideline would never apply. It doesn't make any sense.
I understand you. If there's a specific prohibition against people on probation having guns, although other people are allowed under state law, why wouldn't that fit within the application note?
Because that application note applies to all felons in possession, and the other way to interpret it would be that it would only apply, that note would only apply to states that specifically allow felons to possess firearms. And it doesn't say that. That would directly contradict the guideline itself. The commentary can't contradict it, only has to explain it. But to explain it and exclude it from virtually all states, the guideline itself says that all persons who use for target and sport only get a reduced sentence. The commentary can explain that, but it can't just say, well, that won't apply in any state that has a felon in possession law or a probation. And whether it's unclear whether a misdemeanor person on probation would have been prohibited at that time, but it was his felony status that made him a criminal, and it's the same felony status that made him in violation of the local law. It's not a separate local violation, and that's how I interpret the commentary.
Thank you. Okay, well, thank you, Mr. Beavers and Mr. Ingraham.